Welcome to Big Blend Radio, where we celebrate variety and how it adds spice to quality of life. Welcome, everybody. Today, we get to chat with Peter Kagayama. He is a third-generation Japanese-American, a best-selling author, and an urbanist, and he's a former senior fellow with the Alliance of Innovation. And as a writer and speaker, he's written 4 nonfiction books on cities and urban development. So, you know, we're going to have him back on the show for that. You all know us here, Big Blend. You know, we've got our Parks and Travel show, and we love all of that. But he's also a fiction writer, and his second book in the Katz Takamoto series is out. It is called Midnight Climax. The first one is called Hunter's Point, and I encourage you to go to his website, peterkagayama.com. Welcome, Peter. How are you?
Thank you, Lisa. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, I heard that, you know, you're in St. Petersburg, Florida, beautiful area, and Yes. It's a little cloudy today, so that might be more like San Francisco's weather where your book is set.
Well, you know, weather, you know, impacts the way we think and feel about cities, and some weather is far more dramatic than others. And I think San Francisco has some of the most dramatic weather in the United States. So yeah. You know, hard pressed to live up to that, but yeah.
Oh yeah. Always wear a jacket, right?
Always wear a jacket, even in summer. Yes. Yes,
exactly. But it's a beautiful city. And, you know, when we came back to this country from South Africa, it was like one of the first places I wanted to go was San Francisco. And, there's so much history, and just the history of, you know, we go back to, you know, the Spanish going through with the Presidio, and there's the nuclear history, which that connects over to your family history too, with, you know, also World War II, and just so much cultural history as well. It's amazing.
I mean, San Francisco just doesn't look and feel like pretty much any other city in America. It is very unique that way.
Yeah, the closest I would say would be Cape Town in South Africa. And even that's completely different. Just that coastal port cities, and port cities always have something going on that we shouldn't know about, but we want to know about, right?
And so they're gateways. Yeah. They feel like they connect us to someplace else. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, you know, can we start at the beginning with the series, with Katz Takamoto series, with Hunter's Point? So kind of give us the backdrop. Obviously, San Francisco, as we were saying, but this is going back a few generations, right? So give us a little bit of a backdrop and introduce us to Hunter's Point for those who haven't read it yet.
So Katz Takamoto is a Nisei, a second generation Japanese American. He's a private detective, and the stories are set in San Francisco starting in the late 1950s. Hunter's Point takes place essentially in 1958, which is the height of the Cold War, which would, of course, go on for another 25 years. But, you know, it was raging at the time. And Katz is a former soldier. He served in the U.S. Army in the 442nd, which was a very famous combat regiment that served with incredible distinction over in Europe. He comes back, and the story is, like many of the Japanese Americans who tried to reintegrate into society, he found, you know, he got an education and decided what he wanted to do. And oddly enough, he becomes a private detective. That's part because stories about, you know, accountants are probably not as interesting. But apologies to the accountants out there. Weirder stuff happens to private detectives, which I guess lends a nice platform for telling these kinds of stories.
Yeah, I like this. You know, we actually interviewed a FBI undercover FBI guy in San Francisco who's a musician. He came on the show because Donovan Plant and the New Leafs is his band name, and halfway through the interview I'm all like, I love your music, but can we ask about this? Did you have to wear a wig? But the private investigator side of it is crazy, and then you, when you open up the book of Midnight Climax, it's a little hot and steamy, and then crazy. There's a pace that moves and moves, and you're like, what's going on? What do you mean there's other people watching people? You know, what's going on here? And so this kind of touches in with the whole thing about the CIA that weren't they testing like acid and things like that on people?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, it's been pretty well, you know, covered and documented over, you know, this last generation, when it became public knowledge, that the CIA was doing mind control, thought control experiments from like the 1950s into the 70s. They believed that, you know, the Russians and the Chinese were experimenting with psychotropic drugs, you know, LSD and stuff like that. And they thought they could use that to create either, you know, again, read people's minds, control them, turn them into sleeper agents. It was all kinds of crazy stuff that they thought was, you know, was that was part of the so-called science at the time. And that operation was actually called MK Ultra. And many of our, you know, your listeners might have heard of that because it's become a famous sort of trope that is used in a lot of stories because, again, it was so crazy because it was real. And the title of this second book, Midnight Climax, actually comes from another CIA operation that was actually a subset of MK Ultra, where they were actually using brothels and prostitutes to lure Johns in to secretly dose them and then observe them and try to get them to do stuff. And this occurred in two American cities. It occurred in New York City and San Francisco. And so,
wow, I didn't know New York.
Yeah, when I first read about that, I thought, "Holy crap, that is such a crazy background."
Yeah,
I have to use that as a you know, a setup for a story. And it,
I love that you say Johns too, because that goes back to that era as well. You know, they're luring the Johns in, you know, for $40.
Yeah,
yeah. You know,
yeah.
Like, here it is. Hey, actually, back then that was a little bit more money than what $40 is now. I don't think we can even buy, you know, two cups
yeah,
of
I
coffee.
Didn't, yeah. Trying to, you know, adjust the economies of, you know, of the day. It's like, what would have been, you know, a cup of coffee or the price of a prostitute? Yeah, that's the kind of question you should ask Google. Yes.
Oh my gosh, your Google history has got to be so cool. You know,
yeah,
prostitution, drugs,
oh,
the CIA.
Yeah. Well,
how much
I
is a prostitute back then?
Well, my third book, I won't tell you exactly what's going on with that, but yeah, you're right. If you, you know, a fiction writer's, you know, search history could be a strange thing. It's like, you're either a spy, a terrorist, a pervert, or a writer. Yeah, I guess
or
maybe
a murderer.
That's the
Yeah.
Right
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting, you know, just how you started the book. It's like, okay, I'm in, you know, this is getting wild. But didn't they, you know, with this whole experimenting thing, didn't they do this to Manson, Charles Manson? I don't know if I heard that right. I was
Some
listening to
people
some
believe
podcast.
that, you know, Manson was a I guess you could call him a guest of the state numerous times in the 1960s, I guess, even from the late 50s, if I remember some of my history correctly. So it's possible he was experimented on. I don't know too much, you know, about his, you know, his particular
Yeah.
history. But if it was happening in other places, it is entirely possible. And he was on the West Coast. I do know a little bit of the history. Did you know, for instance, that Charles Manson was in San Francisco during the Summer of Love in 1967?
See? Ooh, that's creepy, isn't it? Yeah, it's there's so many stories about him, like people knowing his people and all of that. So I wonder though if he was experimented on, if that
Who
messed with
knows?
his brain, you know, who knows,
Yeah.
right? But our government has done a lot of experimenting on people, especially people of color over the years. Women of color
Yeah.
have been experimented on and
Yeah.
operated on without them knowing what was really happening. So it's kind of interesting that
Yeah.
governments do that, don't you
There's a
think? It's
sad
kind of
history.
freaky.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we hope it's still history. Like,
We
you
hope.
know.
Yes.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's kind of a freaky thing, but let's go into Cats and the whole series. What spurred you to even start a series? You're going from, hey, let's
Yeah.
take a walk in the park and
Yeah.
make our
Speaking
cities beautiful to,
of. Right.
hey, we've got murder and
Well,
drugs and brothels and stuff going on.
honestly, a big part of it was COVID. I finished my fourth book on cities. It was actually an updated and expanded version of my original book. It's called For the Love of Cities Revisited. It was the 10-year anniversary edition of that. And I'd kind of gotten back into the writing mode. And part of it is, you know, I was reading some really interesting stuff. In fact, the book that I credit most with sort of firing my imagination around this was by a guy named Daniel James Brown. The book was called Facing the Mountain, and it was this nonfiction account of the Japanese American experience during World War II. And some listeners may know Brown from his most famous book, which is called The Boys in the Boat. which is about the 1936 Olympic rowing team from Washington. In fact, they just made a movie about it. It just came out a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. So he wrote this other story or this other book about the Japanese Americans during World War II. And I read it and I was like, oh my God, this is all the stuff that my father never talked about. My father was a Nisei, second generation Japanese mm-hmm. American, full-blooded, you know, Japanese, although he was born in San Francisco. He was interned along with my grandparents and his two sisters. And this was part of the family history that was not really discussed. Like many of his generation, they didn't want to talk about it. So I had to learn about all this stuff by reading this book by, you know, Daniel James Brown. And it's just amazing stuff. And it kind of, I thought, well, what that, again, you think that would be a really interesting background for a character. And mm-hmm. you start thinking about where would that character live? It's like probably San Francisco, which is the epicenter of sort of the Japanese American community.
Yeah.
And it started to build on that and build on that. And it's like, you know, one thing led to another. And it's like, well, I'm not doing the other, you know, sort of the city stuff because it was still COVID. So you're, the imagination runs wild, I guess, in sort of strange circumstances like that. And I'm very glad it did.
Mm. And going into your family history, that has to be a little tough, you know, and because at that time, too, like you're saying, it's kind of that quiet history. It's you know, and even from all levels, you know, and different sides of the war, people just kind of kept, you know, the survivors of it kept quiet and moved on, it seems like. People that were really faced with the worst part of the war.
And, you know, again, the Japanese American community kind of just, they kind of said, you know, we don't talk about it, move on. And it was not exactly, you know, a shining moment in, you know, U.S. history. So oftentimes it's kind of glossed over. You know, a lot of people tell me it's like, I really didn't learn about that in, you know, in school. You know, some of them learned about it later in life. Sadly, there's lots of, you know, instances like that in our history that are just either painful, embarrassing, just, you know, just really hard to fathom and hard to deal with. So we tend to, you know, sort of gloss over them or just pass over them. But it was a great way for me to reconnect with my sort of my Japanese heritage. I'm half Japanese. My mom, mm-hmm. You know, which is kind of an unusual, you know, pairing at the time. And I use that actually in my story because Katz meets a redheaded Irish woman from Ohio named Molly in the first book, Hunter's Point. And my mother was a redheaded Irish woman from Ohio who happened to be named Molly. So there's some.
Yeah.
Some, you know, some, there's some family stuff in there in trying to make a good story, but I thought, all right, this would be kind of fun. My dad was never
the wild Irish rose had to persist. Yeah, bring the wild Irish rose in. You know, Molly's a good name for that. You know, but hey, you had to have a Molly in there because you're also talking about drugs. So hey, it's kind of close.
Oh well, there you go.
Hey, good tie in there. I don't know anything. You know, I wouldn't even know what Molly looks like. That's how bad I am at this, but. you know, well, coming to the States, I had a rude awakening about what drugs were. Like, you know,
really?
There's pot and marijuana and weed and all that kind of stuff. That's normal. Like, that's a normal thing.
But it's then, legal in more than half the states now. So yeah,
I mean, that's kind of a normal thing. And then here, like, I didn't know, you know, half of what was going on. And I know that you have a musical background too. And so when we got here and we were living in Southern California and a band and I found out half the band was high all the time. I didn't understand why did your personality change so fast? Oh, meth makes you think that people are spying in your bedroom.
Yeah.
Oh, can't have you as a drummer anymore. So
pot seems very benign compared to, you know, a lot of stuff that's out there now. So yeah.
Well, I don't know. From what I've heard, it's a little different now too. I mean, I grew up in South Africa, and that was kind of a, you know, it's part of the grass. But you know, but it's so interesting to get into this, all of this, because also when you look at Japanese American history, we do cover military history a lot on the show. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. And I can understand the fear from the American side, you know, that when, oh my gosh, because the Japanese, quite frankly, were badass, you know, in regards to war and military. They've always been amazing. You know, your culture's good at it, you know. So I think there was a huge amount of fear. But at the same time, if you look in history, the Japanese have been a huge part of our military protecting this country too. So did you dig into that part as you're getting into the history?
Well, certainly the Japanese American combat team, the combat unit, the 442nd, was an experiment at the time, because remember, in 1942, Roosevelt signs the executive order that says all the Japanese and people of Japanese ancestry on the west coast of the United States have to be moved out of there, basically like a 100-mile wide swath from Washington all the way down to the southern tip of California, which basically sets up these internment camps. And then by 1943, they start realizing, wait a minute, there's a lot of healthy young men in these camps that we would like to, you know, that would, you know, probably, if given the opportunity, they would want to serve. And they did. So this sets up this interesting juxtaposition of these guys volunteering essentially out of prison camps for the U.S. Army. And, you know, the vast majority of them do. They were required to sign a loyalty oath, which was odd because no German American or no Italian American had to sign a loyalty oath. But almost all these young men did. And then they went over to Europe because they weren't allowed to serve in the Pacific, which kind of made sense. Because there was some worry that's like, well, they might see their Japanese ancestors and decide they're more Japanese than American, which was kind of BS. But the real reality is that a Japanese face even in an American uniform, you could have been shot by your own, you know, side just because you looked like the enemy. It's like, so that kind of made sense. So these guys served in Europe and they served with incredible distinction. The 442nd was and remains the most decorated unit in U.S. Army history. They called it the Purple Heart Brigade because these guys had something to prove. And I guess maybe the bit of that samurai spirit or something like that kind of came through it, because these guys were incredibly brave. And sometimes I guess even incredibly stupid, they said, because they felt like they had more to prove because of the color of their skin.
Yeah, I can imagine, you know. Wow. A lot. So you've had to do a lot of history, like a lot of research to get this all together, because you're going back in time. And then at the same time, you've got to know, like, okay, drugs and murder and stuff, you know.
You watch enough television, you've seen tons of drugs and murder by the time, you know, you're an adult. It was more of it was weaving together the actual history and stuff that really happened. How do you use that as as an element of a fictional story? How do you use real people as part of, you know, telling a fictional story? For instance, in the first book, Hunter's Point, Jimmy Stewart and Jack Kerouac are characters.
Sweet.
In the second book, slightly lesser known in some ways, but a guy by the name of Ken Kesey, who famously goes on to write One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm-hmm.
He's a young writer in the second book, Midnight Climax. So trying to integrate, you know, real people and make it part of hopefully what I think is a really good story.
That's fun. I mean, and you're an amazing writer. What's it like going from writing nonfiction into fiction?
It's very different. Very different. If you'd ask me, you know, sort of, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, do you feel like a writer? I said, well, I'm more of a speaker who occasionally writes, because, you know, four books in 10 years was not exactly, you know, Stephen King sort of, prolific. But after, you know, Hunter's Point came out and I thoroughly enjoyed the process and it was very, very different. I kind of embraced that idea. I guess maybe I am a writer. And now I absolutely say, yes, I am a writer. And I really love that. And it is very different. It's a very different mindset. You know, to write nonfiction requires, you know, a certain type of research. You go to places, you observe, you take notes and this. For, you know, fiction, it's like almost you dream up this like wild scenario. And it's like, well, then how would they do that? And then you sort of research how something like that becomes possible, or like what was happening in 1959, in 1960, that you could, you know, possibly use. So it's a different process, but I do love it. I am absolutely loving it.
Do your characters talk to you?
Not in sort of a crazy, is he crazy kind of crazy kind of way. No, I don't hear the voices in my head.
Everyone, Peter's not doing the psychedelics, by the way.
Yeah. But I do feel like I've come to know them, and there's, you know, certain things, and my wife, who's also my first reader, you know, I said in my dedication to the second book, she's my first reader in all things.
And illustrator.
And the illustrator of the books, by the way. Yes, she's an amazing artist. She's an architect. So she's one of those old school architects who can actually draw. So she's made some, you know, did some amazing illustrations for the books. But after a while, you kind of get to know the characters. And there's even been instances, you know, where she would read something, she'd go, that doesn't seem like Cats, or that Molly wouldn't say that, or Shig would do this. It's like, and, you know, so I think she's come to know them as well. And that's actually kind of cool. So yeah, not quite speaking to me in those voices yet, but they do sort of, I do think about them as almost sort of real incarnations in some ways. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about Shig. You know, we've touched on Molly and Cats, but Shig, their friend.
He was a real guy. Shigeyoshi Morao. So Shig was a Japanese American. He was interned at the Minidoka camp up in Idaho. He served during World War II. He's with the Military Intelligence Service, which was the translation group, the translators, Japanese to English, English to Japanese. And in the mid-50s, he goes to San Francisco and he gets a job at City Lights Bookstore. And if any of you have been to San Francisco, you've probably been or you've heard of City Lights. It's this very famous bookstore in the North Beach neighborhood. It is still there. It was known as sort of a radical, outlier artistic bookstore. It was the bookstore made famous by all the beat poets and the beat writers, Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, and those folks. And Shig was the longtime manager of that store. And he became kind of famous because he had the distinction of selling a copy of Allen Ginsberg's book, Howl, to an undercover police officer, which led him to getting arrested for selling obscenity. You can imagine, in 1957, this book was deemed, this poem was deemed obscene, and he was taken to court. And so there's a big, you know, trial. Of course, ultimately, the, you know, First Amendment, free speech wins, and Shig becomes sort of a hero of the, you know, First Amendment, free speech kind of movement. And he kind of basked in that, and he was one of those sort of central connectors in the artistic scene there in North Beach for, you know, for decades. And it was fun to use him to make him Katz's best friend. And again, he was a real guy. And he went through the same experience that Katz did of, you know, internment and serving, you know, in the military and then having to be Japanese or Japanese American, you know, in the post-war era, when I'm sure it was not very, it was very hard to have to look like him, you know, and walk the streets of this American city, because, you know, these guys were the enemy, or guys who looked like him were the enemy, you know, just, you know, yesterday, essentially. So that became part of the balance. And I love how he's become sort of the conscience and a bit of the comic relief in the stories. And yeah, he is Katz's best friend.
That kind of balances out the relationship with Katz and Molly, doesn't it? Having the third person there to kind of buffer that, you know, and so their relationship, they seem pretty tight, but it says, you know, from what I've read, that it's going to get a little complicated in a midnight climax.
Well, they are, you know, again, imagine.
Spill the beans.
No, I won't spill the beans. But interracial marriage or interracial relationships were still provocative, you know, in the 1950s, you know, and onwards even. And you did see, you know, Asians and Caucasians together, but most of the time it was a Caucasian man with an Asian woman, you know, the whole war bride.
Oh, yeah.
So seeing an Asian man with a white woman was kind of transgressive at the time. And my parents, they talked a little bit about that, you know, of what it was like for them. And they were, you know, they met and they, you know, fell in love, got married in Ohio. So, yeah, you can imagine perhaps even more conservative in that sense. So, using, you know, sort of that sort of as a backdrop and that kind of friction, you know, to tell stories, how we have things in common. We're different, you know, in some ways, but we are far more alike in most of the important ways.
I think also Katz, as his character too, being a veteran too, right? And then also his kind of work is he's seeing things that are hard to digest.
You know, they didn't call it PTSD back then. They would have called it battle fatigue or shell shock. You know, and Katz, and no spoilers, Katz goes through a fairly traumatic, you know, event in Europe. He does earn a Silver Star because of it. So he's clearly a brave guy. But, you know, sometimes even those acts of bravery are, it's like it required, you know, something catastrophic happened. And so we see in the first book, we have some of the hints of that sort of PTSD. We explore that a lot more in the second book, Midnight Climax, very much digs into that. And we actually meet the guy who was sort of the psychiatrist that that Katz worked with during World War II. And he plays a very important role in the story that is set there in 1959, because he is treating another soldier who's gone through some amazing, I shouldn't say amazing, so he's gone through some hellish experiences. So it's a way for us to talk about something that is still important today, how we treat our veterans and PTSD and all of that.
Yeah, and understanding and the system is so hard for them, you know, to navigate. It's like, you know, I always say, you know, when someone, you know, goes through cancer or some kind of medical thing, heart disease, you name it, right? Mm-hmm. The worst part is the medical system. It's worse than the disease often, you know, trying to understand what's going on, who to call, the insurance companies,
it's
you know,
so
it just,
it's
yeah,
challenging.
The red tape, the system is just not user-friendly. And I think that's the same way for our veterans coming home. It's not easy. And then it's in your face too, if you do it, you know, it's kind of like, you have to acknowledge what's going on and, instead of being nudged to the helping side, you know what I mean? Nurtured.
Sometimes the hardest thing is simply, you know, asking for help.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And especially think about it, you know, these veterans, most of them, most often you think of men who, you know, have to be strong and brave and, hey, you're a soldier, you're a tough guy, you know, to come back and say, I'm not right. That's got to be incredibly hard, you know, to do. I think we've gotten better over time, certainly, but we still probably have a long way to go.
Yeah, I think so. I think we do. I think, you know, it's interesting with your novel too, your series, is that you're not taking us too far back in history. And at this time now, we're also, everyone's talking about, you know, World War II era is, you know, where they're leaving us now, you know, it's time to go to the next plane. So we're missing some of that history, and it's important to get it out there while people are still here, you know?
Yeah,
and
that's
so
true.
People can connect with, you know, maybe their grandparents, Japanese or, you know, non-Japanese,
anybody,
you know, I'm all sides, you know, to have those connections and communication so that there's more understanding. And a story always makes it easier to have an understanding, you know, textbooks,
absolutely.
like you're saying, you know, high school textbooks, it's like, and this happened and that happened, boom, period. It's like, what? You know, we missed the story, and the history is the story of people, you know?
Exactly. It's, you know, history is, you know, it's this complex. If you look at history as a story, I think you'd try to understand it in a different way. Instead, we teach history as you said, it's a collection of, you know, facts and figures and dates, and names that don't really mean anything. But if you put them into a story, then you can understand, like, okay, what was it like to live in America, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the Soviet Union launching Sputnik, which is sort of part of the backdrop of Hunter's Point, because Sputnik was launched in like October of 1957. And we think of this little tiny satellite. It's like, oh, big deal, they launched the satellite. But no, the point was, is they launched the very first one, and they beat us, the Americans, to it. That was terrifying for folks. And again, so that's hard to, you know, to relate in just a few sentences of dry history, but you put it into a story, then it justifies some of the bad actors in Hunter's Point. They're using that as sort of the excuse to do some other kind of bad things.
It is, it is amazing. Yeah. I mean, and the history is repeating itself now too, isn't it? You know, it's kind of crazy. So having this next book, you know, well, both, it's being in San Francisco as an urban planner. It's got to be, you know, as a planner, but also understanding cities.
Yeah.
You know, people have a thing anti-San Francisco. The homelessness has always been there since I remember. I mean, we've been doing this for years, and it's, you know, traveling the country full time. I'm sorry, I don't know anywhere who isn't having a problem with this, and that means our country has a problem. It's not, it there's, and I think a lot of homelessness comes from from what we've understood through, interviews with, people who work in that field, it's coming from, trauma in
Trauma,
it,
addiction, mental illness,
addiction. And
lots
of
of stuff.
course, we've got,
Yes.
this opioid thing and fentanyl and
Yeah.
all of that. That's
Oh,
really
yeah.
made things, it's insane, I remember 2009, it was 2011 or 12. Yeah, we did an interview. And at that time, the average homeless person's age was 9 years old. And this
Oof.
was after, the 2008 crash, So it took
Yeah.
its toll on families. And so I think San Francisco's always had this bad rap for this. And at the same time, it's also
Yeah.
part of the character in a way of the city to me. They're part of their, it's part of the makeup, That's
Yeah.
just my personal experience. Like, personal thing is like, I wouldn't go there. Just like, I wouldn't say I wouldn't go there over that, and people
Yeah,
do.
honestly, I've been back to San Francisco multiple times in the last, couple of years. Yeah, there are places I would feel a little uncomfortable if, especially if I was, if I was a woman by myself. It's like, yeah, I probably
Sure.
wouldn't walk through the Tenderloin after
Yeah.
dark by
Oh,
myself.
yeah. No.
But during the day, you're fine. But here, the thing about I think the rap that San Francisco's gotten is because it's been, it's very visible, and also because in some ways San Francisco was the height of a lot of very positive urbanity. It was the center of the tech industry, of wealth, and it was the gateway to the Pacific and to Asia, all this stuff. San Francisco has this amazing sort of, reputation. And then when you see that there's sort of like, and here's some really negative stuff there. And I think it's a bit of that. It's like, well, maybe it wasn't all that. And so I think there's, San Francisco's is all, the light has always shown very brightly on them, and now that they are having problems, it's also shining very brightly on those problems. Will San Francisco get through this? Yes, they will. It's still an amazing city. They will figure it out. And again, once they figure it out, I think they become maybe the leading edge of like how other cities can figure it out. Because you're absolutely right. It's not just a San Francisco problem. It's not a California problem.
Oh
It's a
no.
national problem.
It absolutely is. I mean, there's not one city. I mean, we were in Madison, Wisconsin, and I saw, homeless people in the snow. And I'm like, how are you doing this? I'm still cold inside. It's something, and I'm not knocking Madison. Madison's awesome. Madison
Oh,
rocks,
yeah,
but
this is great.
it's just, this is a national problem.
Yes.
And I think people go where they can be warm, except for in Madison. I don't know. Like, yeah, how do you just get out of there? You're stuck there. You're stuck, So it's complicated, but it is part of our history of a con as a country too. And I think a lot of the homelessness started with veterans coming
Yes.
home from Vietnam and even from World War II, and the Korean War and
Even from World War I, actually.
Even
So,
then, really? Wow.
I mean, we get the World War I ends, and what happens almost immediately after that is the Spanish flu. The Spanish
Yeah.
flu made COVID look like, the sniffles by comparison. The Spanish flu was several times more lethal in terms of, people dying from the infection. So there was a lot of stuff that's always happened. And then, we have the so-called Roaring Twenties, and then the crash. And then, you have the depression, when homelessness becomes sort of literally becomes the national, identity of people losing their jobs, losing their homes,
Yeah.
all
Yeah,
the
look at the
public.
Dust Bowl.
Yeah, the Dust
Everybody,
Bowl.
California was settled, the farming country. Part of that is, multiple immigrants
Yes.
coming in. I mean, it's like Tulare County, Central California Valley, San Joaquin Valley,
Yeah.
that area. If you look at the multiple cultures, there's a
Yes.
museum in Visalia, California that showcases all the people involved in agriculture. It goes from Armenia to the Hmong people.
Yeah.
They don't even have their own country anymore. It's just so diverse, which is something to celebrate, really. Diversity is good. It means we all have good food. But at that time, when the Dust Bowl happened, that everyone was homeless doing that. And
Yeah.
I believe it's actually illegal to be homeless, which is weird. So I don't.
I don't know Maybe it was back then. I don't know. It's not illegal to be homeless now. There's all kinds
Really?
of, no, it's not, you're, yeah, it's not illegal to be homeless. The
Huh, I
condition
always thought
that
it was.
the condition means that you can't basically, if somebody's sleeping on the street, you can't arrest them in most places now. If there is, unless there is a place for them to go, you have to have, homeless shelters. You have to have a bed for them somewhere. And that's been the major problem in California, especially in San Francisco, who've not been able to build anywhere near the amount of housing or affordable housing that is necessary. So under the current the under current law, you can't arrest people for being homeless, unless you have a place for them to go. And frankly, there's not a place for them to go, especially in Northern California.
In Midnight Climax, when you delved into this whole thing that the CIA were doing with, the psychedelics and then the, all of these different testings, right? And at the same time, psychedelics were coming out at that time too. Do you
Psychedelics were
think?
legal at that time. LSD was legal until the mid-60s. Did you know that?
Dang. No, I didn't. Didn't. So all this stuff's going on, the shenanigans are happening, but I bet that led to some homelessness too at the end of it. If
Well, we have
people.
there's a little vignette in the story where Katz and his friends come across a couple of guys who are, you call them homeless today, unhoused, and they have a little incident that actually resolves, I think, in an interesting way. The homeless have been part of our country, as you say, from the very beginning. It's just now, we have, ways to document it, and it's all over your Facebook or your Instagram feed. It just seems more visible now.
In Midnight Climax, there's a murder of a young Chinese girl in this. And so now Katz is, going to go investigate that. So that it's cool because now you're going into Chinatown. So now we're getting Chinatown and you're getting like mixed cultures again in this too, which is interesting. So because people I want people to understand, everyone's different, but at the same time we're all the same, right? You know what I mean? So that had to be interesting writing that from
It
two different
was,
perspectives.
especially because the Japanese and the Chinese historically have not gotten along very well. There's a lot of, and that dates back to a lot of stuff happened in centuries ago. But just because we tend to look at the Asian community, it's like there's differences. The Japanese are very different than the Chinese, and the Chinese are not even just the Chinese. There are Chinese who are from the southern China, Chinese from northern China, the Chinese who never were from China, who came from Southeast Asia. So all these these different sort of permutations, that no group is a monolith. And so it was interesting to sort of write that, because I knew about these sort of differences between the sort of the Japanese and Chinese. Growing up as a kid, you're I was kind of aware of that. The only other kids that were that looked anything like me were there's a few Chinese kids in my school when I was growing up, and they were friends of mine, but I knew they came from a different sort of culture than I did.
I have both friends, and growing up in South Africa,
Yeah, there you go.
and in Kenya when we lived there, but in school, yeah, I remember, both industrious people, very smart as all get out, man. And I
Asian.
just thinking the two sides, and but different,
They make
and different cultures. I remember my one friend Brad, going to his house, and his parents were still incredibly from the mother country, basically, and so they'd pretty much just moved there. And there's, I mean, the food, the things they were growing and eating, I had no clue what was going on. It was like a kitchen, to me, looking at them. I was an American kid, but mostly raised in Africa, and but I'm looking at what they had. Like things floating around in jars and going, what is this? Do you have an aquarium going on? And
Wait,
I
you're
just
going to
didn't
eat
have
that?
any clue. Yeah, but they did. And hey, they're healthy, man. And so it was really fascinating for me to learn, and they were very open and welcoming and just I just had really good friends,
Yeah.
you know. It was cool. You don't care as kids without all the stuff that comes with history and
Exactly.
all of that, you know, unless you're taught to be that way, you
Yeah.
know, which I wasn't, you know. So it we just, yeah, you know, and
Well, we should take a lesson from, kids like that, to be open, be curious, not judgmental, to quote, the great
yeah. I went. I went to a
Ted
multiracial
Lasso.
school.
Yeah.
They call it multiracial international school in Kenya as a little kid, and actually got kicked out. But that's a whole other story. But they were. It was Snow White. Nancy, was it Snow White? Yeah. It was a multicultural school, and I was the only white kid, and I got nailed, man. I'm just saying, I got it. You know, it was mostly different black tribes and Indians. And man, but did they teach me, like, they taught me math like you wouldn't believe. And yeah, but I did get kicked out because the Minister of Home Affairs' son kept hitting me, and I hit him back, and I didn't know it was the Minister of Home Affairs' son. But he didn't know what I was, because I was
Politics.
like the only white kid. I was the
Yeah.
only white kid, and I had long hair, blonde hair. And he, you know, he, you know, in his tribe, the Maasai, the men braid their hair really long with clay and mud and everything, and their hair. And so he's looking, and the moms, you know, the mothers, the women shave their heads. So he's like, "What are you?" He was lifting my shirt to see if I had boobs. You know, we were like 5 years old or something, 5, 6 years old. And he would spit on me, which is actually a blessing. Like, I don't know what the heck you are, so I'm spitting on you, you know, to protect myself. And so he started hitting me on my head to make me shorter. And I turned around and it smacked him back. And then Nancy, my mom, got a call saying, you need to take Lisa out of school. And then I ended up in a convent getting my knuckles whacked. So there
By
you
the Catholic, yeah. My dad went to a Catholic school in San Francisco, and they rapped on it. My dad was naturally left-handed. They rapped on his knuckles until he learned how to write with his right hand. So
Are you kidding me? That's wild.
yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So the knuckle thing's real. They used to put your hands under water,
Yeah.
cold water, and do it. Yeah. Don't mess with nuns ever.
Apparently
And
not.
no. Wow. Well, I think we've gone around the world a little bit today and across
Yes,
the
we have.
country. We've
Yeah.
been to what? We've been to Florida. We've been to San Francisco, Utah. Have you been to Manzanar?
I have not been to Manzanar.
Oh,
I need to
yeah.
go. Yes.
That's part of our National Park Service.
Yeah.
And that was one of the internment camps, and we've
Yeah.
been there, but not done at all what we want to do. In fact, I wouldn't even put it as anything that we've done. But it's amazing because you can, we've driven in, and they you can see the different buildings, but
Yeah.
they also had an extensive garden. No matter what was going on, there was this resilience, and
Yes.
that, you know, the Eastern Sierras, is that's cold, man. When
Yeah.
that's cold, it's cold, but they were resilient and, you know,
Yeah, these were
planted
not
things.
heated campsites at all. So, yeah.
No, but how they did, yeah, the buildings I'm talking about, that wasn't like cozy homes, you know. Yeah, it's the resilience of people is something to look up to and aspire to be like, you know, as things get wonky in our world. But thank you so much for joining us, Peter.
My
When's
pleasure,
the
Lisa.
next one?
The
When's the
next
next
one.
one?
I'm working on it right now. The last two have come out in January of 2023, January 2024. I'd say it's a pretty good, it's nice to have a sort of self-imposed deadline. It's like, I think January of 2025 would be a good time to for book three. I'm going to do my best. So, yeah.
Did you think that you were going to do a series, or did you think it was going to be a one-off novel?
No, after I finished the first book, I really fell in love with the characters and knew I wanted to come back and revisit them. And also, if you think about San Francisco entering the 1960s, it's like that's a really rich
Oh.
backdrop to play against, Did anything interesting happen in San Francisco in the 60s? Like, oh yeah, quite a bit.
Yeah,
So,
yeah.
yeah, expect more of that. So,
Cool. Cool.
yeah.
You got to have wavy gravy in there, man. So,
Absolutely.
everyone, Peter Kagayama is the website to go to, peterkagayama.com. The book is Midnight Climax. It is out now. You can get it anywhere you buy books. And try your independent bookstores too. And if they don't have it, ask them to order it.
Yes, please.
Bookshop.org. Are you on there too? On Amazon, all that?
All that, yes.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lisa. Have a great day.
You too.
Thank you for listening to Big Blend Radio. Keep up with our shows at bigblendradio.com.